We sing the song, we hear it sung at many events, but there are so many stories in Spangle history, with some political and controversial performances adding to the intrigue. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
You know, since I was a teen in the 1960s, you can imagine what interpretation resounds in my mind. Can you begin with one of the most infamous performances of the Star-Spangled Banner?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're referring to Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock on August 18th, 1969, Monday morning, just right at sunrise. That is my favorite performance, too. I mean, I have to say, I think it's one of the most profound and deeply moving versions of the Star-Spangled Banner I know. And it's really, in some ways, what inspired my interest in the song, because I've been teaching, you know, history classes about music in the United States for too long, like almost two decades, I guess. And this is always a winner with my students. Just the immediate, you take the visuals from the Woodstock film that was released in 1970, where really the Star-Spangled Banner is sort of the climactic moment of this, you know, three-hour-long documentary. And you see Jimi Hendrix, you know, wearing red, white, and blue. So he's got his bandana and so the fringe psychedelic hippie outfit, if you will, and he just lays it down on electric guitar with Mitch Mitchell playing drums in the background, and really a lot of excitement.
Do you feel like your students of this generation have been introduced to Woodstock through their parents, or do you feel like you really have to start at the beginning?
I mean, to the extent that we have a common culture in the United States with the incredible diversity we have, I think Hendrix's Woodstock Banner is one of the things that unites us in a sense. I think everybody has heard of it, maybe seen it on YouTube. These days, I would say probably students today know it more often than they did even 10 years ago.
And do you feel like Jimi Hendrix was the very first to take the step reinterpreting the Star-Spangled Banner, or do you feel like he was one of many?
In a sense, you know, I think we think of Hendrix as being one of a kind because the fame of that performance is so great compared to the other performances. But I actually think Hendrix in some ways is part of a long tradition that really goes back to the very beginning of the banner. I mean, if you think of Francis Scott Key in Baltimore Harbor, you know, he's sort of in prison on this boat and he sees this unexpected American victory and he wants to celebrate this moment in song and he writes a poem. And it's... that is a kind of personal expression of his relationship to the country that really is the founding spark that creates the anthem in the first place. And Hendrix does the same thing at Woodstock. And I think, you know, in some ways his is the most misunderstood banner performance on one level, because it's a lot of ink and rock criticism has been spilled talking about the banner from different perspectives, either as this sort of a celebration of the sort of the greatest moment in rock history, or conversely, like this completely vacuous, you know, horrific rending or destruction, burning of the flag kind of thing in music. And I don't think it's really either of those things so much as their combination. For me, Hendrix's banner is really sort of both patriotism and protest, both a kind of awareness of this mixed race man, you know, who's younger than he couldn't be president at that time. So he's representing youth at this countercultural moment. But he's also, he's a veteran. He was in the 101st Airborne, and he had friends and buddies who were in Vietnam who were being killed. And the moment of being able to celebrate with this audience at Woodstock, this great festival at the very end, Hendrix is he closes the whole festival, and the festival's so far behind that it's actually Monday morning rather than Sunday night. And he performs this piece as a way of just really saying, this was fabulous. This was so fantastic. You know, he's celebrating a sort of unexpected victory in the same way that Francis Scott Key was.
And did you feel, with all the research you've done into his interpretation, that there was a lot of depth behind the whole presentation, or that it was spontaneous?
That's a really interesting question. And I think something that has vexed a lot of writers on Hendrix's performance, and including his biographer Charles Cross, who claims that the Star-Spangled Banner for Hendrix was just a kind of musical exercise. And I think actually Hendrix was deeply invested in the song, not only because he was an American himself. I mean, he grew up in Seattle, and he was a military veteran, but also because of the sort of relationship to the civil rights movement, to Martin Luther King, to the war in Vietnam, and Hendrix's own politics. And Hendrix was pretty confusing on this matter. I mean, in part because it took him a while to be accepted in the United States. You know, he went to England, and really the experienced trio that made him so famous didn't take root in New York, where he was based. It took root in London. And so he really came back and played at Monterey Pop, and at that point, America was ready for him. But we didn't quite know what to do with an African-American psychedelic guitarist. I mean, it didn't really fit into what was jazz or black music. It didn't really fit into what was, you know, white music and rock and roll. So he was a kind of a hybrid who didn't have a place initially. And you know, his own politics, I think he was quite careful to not say something in public that would turn sort of the mass media against him. So a lot of his public statements are pretty ambiguous. The interesting thing, I think, about the banner, and this is a problem with Woodstock sort of overshadows everything in Hendrix's history. So we think of Hendrix as having been, like, moved by the spontaneous moment of this festival to realize his anthem on the electric guitar. But in fact, Woodstock is really the midpoint of a two-year fascination with the banner. So Hendrix has played, I have documents that show him playing this song at least 50 times. So most people just think he played it this one time. But in fact, this is a, you know, a polished composition, a polished piece of musical expression for Hendrix by the time of Woodstock.
And did over that period of the 2 years when he was almost obsessed with the Star-Spangled Banner, what was his relationship like with the other musicians who were involved? Was the band morphing? Was he always with the same people? Mm-hmm. It seems like that would play into what happened at Woodstock.
Yeah, it does. I mean, initially he's playing with the trio, The Experience, and that's Mitch Mitchell on drums and Noel Redding on bass, and both of those musicians are actually British. And they usually Mitchell plays, you know, pretty ecstatic drums behind Hendrix's performance, and you see that at Woodstock. Redding actually isn't at Woodstock. The Experience trio has broken up just a couple months before Woodstock, and he's actually with sort of a pickup group that he calls Gypsy Sun and Rainbows. So it's a different ensemble entirely, and part of this is, you know, the musicians really aren't that tight at that time. They don't know Hendrix that well, and he just sort of takes off on what the set was supposed to be over, and then Hendrix, as I say, you know, I think is moved by his sort of profound joy in the moment to play the Star-Spangled Banner.
It seems like such a, you know, an incredibly radical and moving experience, but this, you had mentioned, was at the very end of an intense time. Do you think it loosened him up and gave him permission to go on and do it? Or do you think that he would have had an even bigger reception had he been in the middle of this event?
I don't know. That's a really good question. The audience is definitely an important part of it. And if you listen to the, you know, the live recording, you hear the sort of groundswell of cheers coming from the audience when they recognize the tune, because you just hear the dee da da, and you know immediately what the tune is going to be. So I think it was really relating and connecting with that audience. He definitely was inspired, you know, by the moment and this particular event.
So, Mark, I always found Jimi Hendrix fascinating, but now I'm beginning to imagine the process that he went through just with this one particular song. And I'm wondering if you can take us back a little to how it all began.
Yeah, I think of it as the Hendrix banners, plural, you know, rather than the Hendrix banner or just Woodstock. And what's interesting is it actually doesn't even start as the Star-Spangled Banner. And it really gives an insight into what motivates Hendrix, I think, to embrace this song. It actually starts with a performance of Taps. And Taps is the Civil War sort of eulogistic tune, you know, that's really a kind of mournful celebration or mournful cry for the dead, you know, the dead soldier. And as I said, Hendrix was a member of the 101st Airborne, and his friends were in Vietnam and being killed in Vietnam. And so he initially starts playing in early August of 1968 in Dallas. He does a full rendition of the Civil War bugle call Taps. And then a couple weeks later, the Meriwether Pavilion in Columbia, Maryland, he does what I consider the first Star-Spangled Banner, the first Hendrix banner. And in this case, it's really a set of bookends to a performance of Taps. So rather than it being the Star Spangled Banner, that as Woodstock, as you know, has taps inserted in the middle of it, what we start with is actually a remembrance of Jimi Hendrix's friends, right, who are suffering in Vietnam, and as a performance of taps that then has these short references to the Star Spangled Banner at the beginning and the end. And then eventually this will grow into a full-blown performance of the Star Spangled Banner with the taps reference in it.
Was the response good, or was he so in the moment that it didn't matter?
You know, I think the audience largely doesn't respond to the early performances. So you hear on the tape that people are sort of talking, or, you know, they're just like people at a rock concert. So, and Hendrix, of course, is doing a lot of improvisation. I mean, pieces like Red House were these long blues jams, and, you know, he's throwing in different gestures and ideas and musical references all the time. So to hear the Star Spangled Banner was not really that remarkable. It's actually only after Woodstock and the Woodstock documentary film in 1970 that people's expectations change. So the very final tour of Hendrix's life is in the Axis of Love tour, starts in April of 1970. And the Woodstock film comes out in March of 1970. So many people in the audience have probably already seen the film. So it's really at this point that when Hendrix plays Dim Do Dum, that the audience starts to erupt and starts shouting because they recognize this performance. And it's an interesting shift artistically, because I really see Hendrix's Woodstock as a kind of set of improvisational possibilities. And he could be way more critical or way more protest-oriented in his arrangement than he was at Woodstock. So Woodstock I see as a pretty affirming patriotic version, because it starts with the Star Spangled Banner, it ends with the Star Spangled Banner, taps is in the middle, it's all presented very cleanly, it's in tune, it's in rhythm, the sort of improvisatory psychedelic departures are illustrative. So when the song's lyrics go to bombs bursting in air and rockets with glare, that's when you get these wild, you know, sort of peals of feedback. Or in the second one in particular, the kind of tritone alternation, which is it sounds like a police siren maybe in a race riot in Washington, D.C. or Chicago or Detroit. So that those kind of sounds really rooted in both the civil rights movement in the United States and also with the war in Vietnam. But at Woodstock, he comes back to the banner. I mean, he makes that final statement, "Oh, say does that star-spangled banner that wave the land of the free and the home of the brave." And that's presented, you know, as a kind of conclusion that really reaffirms the flag. And he even uses the wah-wah pedal and the whammy bar in ways that where the sound goes wah-wah-wah-wah. It's almost like the flag is waving. So it rather than a destruction of the flag, I really think Woodstock's a celebration, because, again, he's so happy that the whole Woodstock Music and Art Fair has been such a huge success. At the Winterland Ballroom in October of 1968, so, you know, almost a little bit less than a year before, that's actually the second anniversary of the experience, and they do four concerts in San Francisco. And San Francisco, of course, hotbed of political protest for Vietnam and the student movement. And here, he does a kind of a 6.5 minute long Star Spangled Banner that he actually titles from the stage.
Well, they continue on with a thing called This Is America, representing the sounds and the feedback which you'll hear. It's really lost souls in a frustration, it seems like to me. I don't know, the weirdest messengers, you know. And like, you know, if we can get this feeling across.
She says, this is a piece we call This Is America. So it's a kind of portrait of America. And it sounds more like Ornette Coleman, this kind of free jazz improvisation, you know, really atmospheric and much more radical. And in this case, he brings in parts of the Star Spangled Banner melody. Some things are out of tune, and, you know, Hendrix was obsessed with tuning. When he's out of tune, it's on purpose. It's not an accident. And then he actually throws in a bunch of commercial jingles. So you hear the theme song from the television show Bonanza. You hear the theme song from the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports. You hear the theme song from the Mickey Mouse Club. It's kind of mocking sort of the triteness, if you will, of American culture. And then it taps comes in, but it ends with taps, and the whole piece sort of just explodes and dissolves. So if he wanted to be critical, if he wanted to sort of destroy this picture of America he's painting, he knew how to do it. So at Woodstock, it's a much different thing. We hear that out of context as being sort of incredibly surprising that a black man in America with an electric guitar could perform the anthem, right, which is supposed to be sung in whatever it is, much different than that. So the very act of doing it at Woodstock is startling to some. But in terms of Hendrix's art, I think it's a really positive version. In this 1970 Axis tour, what's interesting about the banner is that this range of possibility that we see at Winterland with this free jazz improvisation and much more flexible arrangement, the piece really calcifies. In a sense, it becomes a kind of echo of Woodstock so that the audience, you know, they recognize the opening gesture of the anthem and they sort of, I think, expect to hear what they saw in the movie, because way more people saw it in the movie than, of course, saw it at the Woodstock fair, because, you know, that Monday morning and all the mud, most people had gone home. The audience at that point is probably like 50,000, not 250,000. So most people really know it, and its fame really, I think, comes from the movie. And so people expected it to be that way. And if anything, it gets sort of a little bit calcified or sort of petrified in this kind of form. And so he does it pretty much the way it's at Woodstock. He adds a lot more sort of Baroque ornamentation, little trills and things. It's a little bit like maybe he's even getting bored with having to echo his own previous, now way more famous, performance. But what he does, I think, to keep it alive for himself is he actually puts it in the ending of his set list. And so he usually plays the Star Spangled Banner at the end of the concert, and it's paired with Purple Haze, which he's sometimes called the African-American national anthem or an alternative national anthem, along with Voodoo Child, which usually ended up after that, and then was preceded by a piece called Machine Gun, which is overtly anti-war and really talks about kind of sort of humanizing the enemy. You know, I have to shoot you and you have to shoot me, and you're evil and I'm evil. And there's this kind of moral ambiguity in Machine Gun, and of course this sort of rapid fire, you know, musical effects, almost like sound effects in a movie of a gun firing that are part of that as well. And so it's really what I see it as is that the whole end of the concert, like these four or five pieces that Hendrix puts out at the end, including the Star Spangled Banner, are a kind of anti-war, you know, suite, if you will, you know, of a set of compositions making this larger argument about the fact that we need to get out of Vietnam. And that's really clear, particularly in the stage banter, that he speaks from the stage. And so he'll reference, you know, deserters in the army. He'll reference sort of soldiers in Vietnam and soldiers at home. You know, the claim that this is a musical exercise, I think when you listen to the audience tapes and listen to what he's saying, just completely unjustifiable. It's so clear to me that this is a political statement for Hendrix, and that he's actually pretty subtle in his thinking and very informed by the news. You know, he was a news junkie, I think, because he often speaks from the stage, like right after Kent State, he mentions that tragedy, and he's not someone who's sort of drugged out and tripping. He hasn't checked out.
Mm. Do you feel like what Hendrix did with the banner sort of closed the door on the banner possibilities, or no?
There are a lot of electric guitarists and even bassists today who will, you know, perform an homage to Hendrix by performing the banner. And certainly if you hear it on electric guitar, it's hard not to hear it as a kind of echo of Jimi Hendrix. But there are string artists and you know, classical musicians who have performed the Star Spangled Banner sort of a la Hendrix. And then I think these days, you know, at sporting events, particularly national events like the Super Bowl or the World Series, things like that, you know, artists are sort of expected to put their own stamp on the banner, to sing themselves into citizenship, I would say, you know, that they're meant to be American and presenting a symbol for the country, but they're also sort of showing their personal devotion and connection to the song through, you know, through their performance. So I think Hendrix in many ways, you know, I would argue as part of this long tradition going back to Francis Scott Key and then Jose Feliciano in the 1968 World Series and then Hendrix a year later and then, you know, Marvin Gaye at the NBA All-Star Game in 94 and, I mean, even Christina Aguilera at the Super Bowl, you know, a couple years ago, which, you know, if you forget the words, you're going to get in trouble. But I think in terms of her performance, you can hear the sort of personal devotion that she has. I mean, that it's not just a kind of, you know, meaningless ritual. It's really a heartfelt song. And if there's any version that's sort of more heartfelt than Hendrix at Woodstock, I don't know which one it is. It's interesting to think, you know, what would Hendrix have done with the banner had he lived? And, you know, what other moments would he have responded to, you know, Watergate, you know, other issues, that he, I think, would have found a way to give another snapshot of the country through a performance of the anthem. And so the thing I think is beautiful about Hendrix's performance is that it is something that's dynamic and changing. It's not a static, you know, permanent composition, and it's not a realization or a rendition. It's really his own artistic reconfiguring of a set of sonic symbols that include this very powerful song that, you know, all of us as Americans have this deep relationship to, that we, you know, may probably started in elementary school, if not before, you know, where we sang this with our friends, and it was part of what it meant for us to come together as a people. And when Hendrix uses those same notes, it speaks for me immediately to someplace really deep, you know, that it just sort of grabs you. So in that sense, I'm not surprised your father was sort of on you about this version, because it's a song that really is profoundly significant for all of us. And what I'm so grateful for is the way these artists have given us their vision of the country, you know, and the beauty of our country, I think, in many ways, is it has changed. I mean, we have this constitution that's flexible and it's able to deal with a world of slavery and a world post-slavery, and that we were able to change and grow as a country. And the way in which our musical artists, you know, have realized this song in different ways is part of what reflects that growth of the American spirit in really positive and beautiful ways. And I think that's, you know, I've collected about 400 or so versions of the Star Spangled Banner. Hendrix is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the most powerful rendition in many ways, but it's the diversity of these musical expressions rather than the sort of, you know, the official version, if you will, that really makes it special.
So, Mark, you mentioned that Hendrix had been working on the Star Spangled Banner long before Woodstock. What was one of his most controversial performances before Woodstock?
One of the performances that shocked people the most, I mean, particularly the reviewer of the LA Times, was his performance at the LA Forum in 1969. So it's really just a few months before Woodstock. And it's with the experience. They haven't broken up at this point. And what's interesting about it, and I think speaks to Hendrix's mindset really throughout this whole two-year history of his banners, is that he's responding to what's happening right there in the moment. So, as I said, it's a kind of flexible set of musical symbols rather than an arrangement. So what happens here is that Hendrix actually, it's almost a kind of acoustic version. I mean, he pulls back the energy level considerably, but he speaks over the performance, and he actually says, you know, here was a song we was brainwashed with. So let's just listen to a little bit of this, and I'll explain why I think this version is what it is. So what's interesting here, and this you really get if you listen to the entire audience tape, is that throughout the performance, Hendrix is sort of telling his audience to sit down, you know, be quiet, don't rush the stage, I want to play music for you, you know, chill out. And what's happening here is that, you know, Monterey Pop and some of these, Hendrix's fame and excitement that he generated on stage was so great that it was really unprecedented in the history of music, in a sense, up to that time. And so these big concerts in stadiums like the LA Forum, you know, nobody knew how to deal with them. I mean, Woodstock, you know, it becomes a free concert because the crowd literally sort of runs over the fences and they can't charge ticket. You know, they can't check the tickets anymore because everybody can just walk in and walk out. So these big, huge festival events were new. And so one of the bits of anxiety that happens in LA is between the security forces of the stadium and Hendrix's fans. And they want to get up and dance. They want to rush up, be on the stage, be close to the music. And the security is sort of freaking out. And they're actually pushing and wrestling and hitting his fans with batons. And so he's trying to protect them. And so I think part of the reason why it's this sort of low-energy performance is he's trying to keep it calm. You know, he's not doing what he's doing at Woodstock, where it's 50,000 people and we're going to just be really excited and thank you for surviving this incredible rainstorm overnight. He's saying, you know, relax, I want to play for you. I'll play some extra music if you just stay calm. And his sort of most profound statement comes right at the end of the song where and here, I think Hendrix always has the words in his head as he's playing. And in that final phrase, which is, you know, oh, say, can you see it? And that the land of the free and the home of the brave. When he gets to the word free, he actually pulls the guitar out of tune. So the word free becomes really ironic, as if, you know, how could we possibly be free in a country where we can't even go to a concert without being harassed by the police? And this is crazy that my fans are being attacked. And so this particular version is often written about as, you know, this kind of insult to the flag. But it has nothing to do with the sort of broader patriotic statement, I don't think, at this moment. It's really a kind of questioning of where are we as a country that young people, that my fans, can be attacked in my concert. One of the most interesting versions of Hendrix, and I think the one that sort of opened my mind to this possibility of Hendrix being sincerely patriotic and really celebrating the song, is this version, which I call the record plant version. So it's done at a studio in New York City. And Hendrix was a gear geek in many ways. I mean, he was a master of feedback, of using the sort of these early amplifiers against themselves in a certain way to mess with the sound system within the auditorium. But he also was interested in effects pedals, and he was interested in recording techniques. You know, so the Beatles were connected to Hendrix, and, you know, also fascinated with all sorts of studio techniques. So one of the things that Hendrix did is that he went to a studio in New York called the Record Plant, and I think it was a 24-track setup, an Ampex setup, you know, which was just mind-blowing for the time. I mean, Motown songs are made on 2- and 3-track, you know, recording equipment. So this is an incredible number of layered voices. And he spent an entire night, you know, all the way through the night, making this version where he records himself at half speed and then doubles it and then performs it. You know, so there are not only are there like multiple guitars, 24 guitars, but some of these guitars are shifted an octave up to sound like little altissimo guitars, if you will, and some of them sound like basses, but it's all Hendrix playing. And for me, this is a kind of musical 4th of July fireworks that just show that he loved this song. I mean, it's quite sincere. This is not a gimmick for Hendrix. He's not playing with people, or it's not a random thing. It was something he's really deeply invested in.